ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's the era we're living through right now most like? What earlier time in history? The massive increases in oil prices make it seem like the 1970s. But back then, wealth was distributed fairly evenly. And the generations starting out didn't feel ripped off by their parents' generations. In fact, they felt grateful. Things were turning out better for them than they had for their parents. Not now. Young Australians, all sorts of Australians, all sorts of Americans, all sorts of Europeans are angry. And they're voting for, or talking about, voting for strongmen, autocrats, parties like One Nation in Australia, Reform in the UK, Donald Trump in the US, anyone who will promise retribution, vengeance, anyone who'll promise to turn the tables on both sides of politics, anyone who'll promise to burn down the house. Might this era be more like the 1930s than any other time? And can what came next, after the 1930s, give us a clue as to what'll happen now? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest this week, Viktor Shvets, an Australian born in Ukraine, who's worked for investment banks in Sydney, Melbourne, Hong Kong, London, New York and Moscow, and is the author of a book making the point that right now is a lot like the 1930s. It's called The Twilight Before the Storm, How to Avoid a World on Fire. And someone who's been following these trends closely at the ABC, and a member of one of the generations with reasons to be resentful, business and economics reporter Gareth Hutchins. Welcome, Viktor, and welcome back, Gareth.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Viktor, the things that seem to most define this era, the one we're in now, are climate change, an astounding new technology, unprecedented in the form of AI, unimaginable and growing wealth at the very top, and resentment and plummeting trust almost everywhere else. I want you to paint a picture for us of the era you think is most like this one.
As you said early on, Peter, I do think 1930s is probably the most comparable period. If you think, what are the commonalities? Number one, you have a technological change. 1920s and 30s were very turbulent technology-wise.
We forget that.
We do. People tend to forget that most people in 1910s were in agriculture and in the rural areas. By the time we get to 1930s, it was completely urbanized. There was also a great deal of financialization and financial crises that occurred in the period. As you mentioned, Peter, it was also the time of extreme inequalities. It actually goes back into 1880s, 1890s, but it continued to increase as we've gone through 1920s into early 1930s. There was also distrust of the system. People felt that the system is failing them. It's not delivering for them, for their children, for their communities. And so people were reaching out for extremes. They basically were prepared to follow anybody who will somehow ease the pain they were experiencing. And so as a result, there was no confidence in the parties, in political system. There was no confidence in the international system. You have to remember, the League of Nations, and today's equivalent of the United Nations, the League of Nations really collapsed as we went through the 1930s. Now, a lot of people do compare it to 1970s. And as Peter, as you correctly said, for example, oil prices and inflation. But 1970s was not technologically disruptive. It was not financially disruptive. There was no climate change. Just keep in mind, 1930s were known as a dry decade. That was a dust bowl, whether you're in Australia or South Africa or the United States.
We'd also just had a pandemic around the time of the 1930s.
That's right. That's right. And so if you think of all of those factors, you will say, okay, 1970s is not the right comparison. Neither fascism, nor communism, nor totalitarianism was rising in 1970s. But in 1930s, everybody was questioning the system.
Gareth, does this seem like a description of today, 90 or so years on?
It does. The feeling of resentment among younger Australians has been brewing for years. A lot of it's linked to housing, to the lack of job prospects, to job insecurity. It's linked to climate change, the destruction of the environment, the fact that we have political parties that seem unwilling to want to course correct. John Maynard Keynes, he gave a speech in Dublin in 1933 called National Self-Sufficiency. And it was picking up on this point as well. He was looking around and seeing people that were furious at what the globalization of the 1890s and early 1900s had led to, with the survival of the fittest, that type of theology that had been pushed through by famous liberals. He was seeing the rise of fascism and strongmen in the 1920s and 30s in Europe. And he was saying that he could understand why countries were now wanting to roll back from globalization and to become more nationally self-sufficient. And so he said, well, we're entering a period where there will be many experiments, many of them will go wrong, but something has to change. And you read that and there are parallels, there are deep parallels.
Victor, the meat of your book is about generations. Most of the time, despite what we like to say about our parents, each generation is much like the one before it. But you reckon there was a massive break after the Second World War. The war generations had rebuilt economies, restored a role for strong governments, ushering in what turned out to be decades of improving living standards. Can you describe that break, the way in which baby boomers were and became fundamentally different from any generation that had preceded them?
If you think of generations who are born in 1910s and 1920s and 1930s, they had a terrible time. They experienced pandemics, they experienced climate change, depressions, wars. And so by the time we end 1940s, a new consensus emerged. And that consensus essentially said that there has to be some guardrails, that the private sector and the private market left to its own devices could lead to devastating outcomes. So we do need some guardrails. The problem with baby boomers, however, was that they never experienced that bad stuff. They just saw educational opportunities. They saw rising standards of living, productivity. And so what baby boomers wanted is freedom. And even though in late 1960s, they were not yet a majority, they did not become electoral majority until late 1970s. But from late 1960s, they started to have an impact. And what they wanted is freedom to choose. Who should I marry? Where should I work? How many jobs am I allowed to change? What am I allowed to do? What I'm not allowed to do? Give me freedom. Give me rope.
I think about Woodstock in that context, right?
That's right. That's right. Essentially, you can argue there was no difference between Woodstock and love and sex and LSD on the one side and investment bankers in 1980s on the other. They're the same people.
Literally the same people, some of them, right?
That's right. They were. And so were the with demanding is freedom. Give me the rope and I can either hang myself with or I can succeed. And so they ushered a new era. You can argue that Ronald Reagan, Maggie Thatcher, Milton Friedman, all of those guys rose to power on the back of baby boomers. It didn't really matter whether you're Labour Party or you're Liberal, whether you're Democrat or Republican. Everybody was singing from roughly the same hymn book.
This consensus was that there was not really a big role for government, that we didn't need big daddy, big government looking after us.
And in fact, the government is inefficient, unjust, and should get out of the way, and private sector solutions are the best. Yes.
And we were really clever. I'm one of those generations. You're one of those generations, Victor.
Yes.
We were of the view, perhaps on average, that it was our own hard work, our own cleverness that had got us the very good life, ever-increasing living standards we'd had. And we didn't need guardrails. We didn't need government support.
That's right. That's right. In fact, guardrails were slowing us down. Now, admittedly, that led to a lot of freedom. So, for example, without baby boomers, I wouldn't have changed as many countries as I have changed in my life. I wouldn't have got married and divorced and married again. So, yes, baby boomers have achieved a lot of things. They opened doors, whether it's racial discrimination, cultural discrimination, sexual discrimination. A lot of things that baby boomers have ushered in was actually a very good freedom to do things. But every piece of freedom has its price. And the price gradually was accumulating, whether it's a globalization without considering the impact either on local communities or environment or whatever that will be, whether it's a deep financialization. Because remember, baby boomers wanted wealth and continuous growth. The only way you can deliver it is by bringing forward future consumption. And so, as I said, freedom has its price. And that price has been accumulating through 80s, 90s, 2000. And finally, the bill arrived around the global financial crisis.
Oddly, I suppose they needed the government to do this. They needed the government to allow the financial instruments to grow, to assure that the share market would remain strong. They had an anti-government ideology, but they could not have accumulated their wealth without the government, without macro management.
That's right. It's Frankenstein's monster that you wanted all of those things, but you couldn't get it on the back of your productivity. So what you needed to do is actually the government to do it. So when a lot of people blame central banks for what has happened, I basically say, you know, when you get up in the morning, look yourself in the mirror, it's you. The government simply delivered to you what you wanted. You just didn't know the consequences. And so if you think of the next generation coming in, say anybody born from early to mid 1980s onwards, they've experienced a very different world. They have seen all of those negatives come through. And so that's another rupture that is occurring. You had a rupture of the prior generations going into 50s and 60s, the baby boomers. And then you have another rupture that started to occur over the last 15, 20 years.
Gareth, when I told you about Victor's thesis, and you were born in the 1980s, you said, I know this whole story. Our generation talks about this stuff all the time. What has your generation been saying all of the time?
I was born in 1982. We've been seeing it around us our whole lives. The people who've benefited from the post-war boom pulled the ladder up after them. They inherited an incredible economic policy platform. It had its problems, but it delivered full employment, cheap housing, stable careers, a manufacturing industry that provided jobs for different generations within the same family. After benefiting from that system, though, they then turned around and started destroying it in the 80s and 90s. The financialization that followed, it blew asset prices out of control and destroyed the relative value of labor, made it incredibly difficult to get housing. I mean, it's all there.
Do you really dislike the generation that has come before? That's my generation. That's Victor's generation.
No.
I suppose dislike what we've done.
No, it's not disliking you personally or what you've done. One thing that really makes it incredibly difficult to have the conversation, though, is the seeming unwillingness to understand by some people in your generation of how much the world has changed since you came up, since you were in your 30s and 40s. So it's not a resentment of your material possessions or wealth. It's a frustration with your inability to see how different things are now and how things are not as easy as they were because the systems have all collapsed.
I find it hard to recognize that. My mental model of the world, maybe Victor's, is that things are getting better. Now, I know that's not true at the moment. But that's still the mental model I carry around with me. And it is not the mental model that my children carry around with them. And it's probably not the mental model that anyone born a decade or so after me carries around. That brings us to what's likely to happen next, if this is in many ways like the 1930s. A tech boom, very, very high inequality, increasingly precarious employment and burning resentment. Can what happened next after the 1930s give us a guide to what's in store. Hopefully not a world war. Joining us on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, a global strategist, Victor Schwetz, author of The Twilight Before the Storm, How to Avoid a World on Fire, and ABC Business and Economics reporter Gareth Hutchins. Victor, Gareth's generation and the ones after will soon constitute the majority of voters and the majority worldwide. They've reason to resent an awful lot, including what both sides of politics have been saying, what you've described as the neoliberal consensus. What kinds of parties, what kinds of programs, what kind of ideologies were they drawn to in the 1930s?
Well, essentially, in the 1930s, if you ran on the relatively conventional, middle-of-the-road, rational agenda, you failed. Essentially, you had to be on extremes, either left or right. And most of the time, communists and fascists actually do agree on a lot of very basic economic elements. Where they differ is some of the social, cultural, racial issues. But in terms of economics, they're actually very close. So today, the same thing. In the US context, you either become a Mamdani, who is our socialist mayor of New York, or you go to J.D. Vance in a Republican Party. But you can't be in the middle. You can't be irrational because people don't want rationality. They want answers. They want action. This is the time for a strongman. This is the time of monsters. And the question is, how far does it go? Because young people have a variety of objections and grievances, a lot of them justifiable. One of them is what we discussed early on, and that's the bill for neoliberal policies that we've pursued over about three decades and the consequences of that. But the other thing that is happening, of course, is the information revolution, what I call the Fujiwara effect.
This is a meteorological term. You better explain what it is.
Yeah, Fujiwara effect, it's a meteorological term, which basically, occasionally it happens that two hurricanes or typhoons, whatever you want to call them, they come very, very close to each other and they merge and they become a much larger typhoon, potentially much more disruptive. And so my entire thesis is that whenever we have those sorts of disruptive moments, usually technology is present, finance is present. Quite often there are complicating factors in pandemics, healthcare, climate, and quite often demographics. So if you've got all of those five or six elements in the same place, that's when you have a highly disruptive period.
Why did things turn out so well last time? Now, I know there was the Second World War, okay? I know it wasn't smooth, but you had President Roosevelt in the US. He defanged a lot of the worst excesses of big business, broke up corporations. He supported trade unions, and he managed to begin a process where wealth inequality and eventually racial inequality in the US really shrank to long-term lows. What happened? Was it luck? How on earth did things turn out? You've subtitled your book, How to Avoid a World on Fire. How on earth was the world on fire eventually resolved in a way that was okay?
The U.S. was incredibly turbulent in 1930s. KKK, Ku Klux Klan, started to rise rapidly in 1920s and 1930s. Communist Party was growing. There was the only episode in U.S. history of a potential military coup occurring in 1930s as well. So you could argue it's probably luck that FDR managed to get control. He had a policy to try to defang the extreme. He tried everything he could, from economic policies to infrastructure, to changing the relationship between labor and capital, to Security and Exchange Commission. FDR was a critical element of getting through to the other side. Because ultimately, every human society finds a consensus. It's just a question, do we need a war? Do we need destruction? Do we need to reset the entire societies in order to find that consensus? Or can we have policies that actually will lead us to that consensus without the degree of devastation that experienced in the 1940s?
What do you see happening here, Gareth? And I'm asking you partly as a representative of your generation, but also the one after it.
Yeah, well, last year the ANU's Australian Election Study found that millennials were the first generation to move left as they age. But that was last year. You know, according to recent Redbridge polling, apparently more millennials are suddenly willing to vote for One Nation over Labor. Now, that suggests that there's a huge amount of flux among younger people in Australia. When it comes to our experience of the unfettered free market, the power the corporations have today, the fact that there's been a concerted effort in Australia over the last 30 years to undermine our old property-owning democracy and prioritise the feelings of landlords over renters, the fact that we're told to reframe the problem of job insecurity as an opportunity to have multiple careers, all of these things contribute to this growing feeling of powerlessness. So if you're surprised that younger people are now screaming about wanting to have more control over their lives, and if that leads to calls for more government control of the economy, more control of borders, more control of business.
You're sort of shocking me because I must be so out of touch. Young people actually support control of borders?
Well,
is that why they're voting for One Nation? I thought it was just a protest.
I think it is at the moment, is just a rejection of the duopoly in Canberra.
The survey after survey actually highlighted over the last 15, 20 years, the younger generation doesn't have a great deal of a good view of democracy across the countries, from the US to Europe to other places. They don't really value democracy as much as the older generations do. They view it as a part of the broken system. And so what they're doing is that they're not necessarily going left or right. I think those definitions are somewhat obsolete. They're going towards parties that they believe will be able to change the system on their behalf. And because a lot of left and right policies, as I said, are very similar, that's why if you think of the United States, Donald Trump has a great relationship with Bernie Sanders for many, many years. And the reason is simple. Neither of them believe in free markets. Both of them were supporting tariffs or reduction in trade. So there is a lot of commonality. And so you can argue left or right. To me, the really dividing line between left and right is much more cultural than economic.
How is AI likely to feed into this? You've talked about it as being even bigger than the earlier technological revolutions. What's, I suppose, in the best case, what's that likely to deliver, and what's our best way of handling it?
The late Kevin Drum had a terrific quote. He basically said, look, industrial revolution changed the world, and all it did is to replace human muscle power. Information revolution replaces everything, including cognitive function. So in other words, it's much more disruptive. The problem is, how do we go from today's society to the next one? And is it true that anybody older than 5 years old is really a sacrificial lamb? In other words, they will never be able to adjust through this period. What policies can we put in place to defund the extreme, to avoid the degree of violence that otherwise will happen?
Is universal basic income one of those? One of those, I suppose, FDR, defanging,
yes,
middle way?
Yes. UBI, to me, is a necessary tool. It's not encouragement to be lazy. It's compensation for irrelevancy. Humans become less and less relevant. Because you're less relevant, we're compensating for being irrelevant. So that's the way I look at UBI. UBI is a bridge between today's society, which is still based around jobs, around professions. We try to glorify it, that you can have three jobs now, four jobs. You know, you can be a taxi driver, an IT professional, and then you make cookies in the evenings. But in reality, what it tells you is that labor markets are disintegrating, professions are disintegrating, and we just try to make the best out of it. So instead of forcing people to find those different paths, UBI should be able to guarantee you certain income, and then you go on and discover what you're good at. You know, maybe you should be a poet rather than an economist, but you're really interested in something else. So to me, UBI is one of those bridges between today's society based on work, based on jobs, and a future infinite productivity society.
Does that sound like a fairly good outcome, Gareth, with people being paid to do what they want, I suppose, is a way of avoiding a world on fire.
Sounds like a good outcome, but realistically, I can't imagine a world in which those in power would be happy to have millions of citizens with free time on their hands, free time to think, to read, to create. You want people to be kept busy so that they can't be doing those things. Because if people are too free with their time, then perhaps there'll be some political instability. I mean, we can see why the people in Silicon Valley who are pushing these AI models on us are also talking about universal basic income for the same reasons that Victor has said. But politically, how would we change our culture to get to a position where it's acceptable for everybody to be not only having universal basic income, but having all this free time on our hands? I really worry about that.
I agree completely. At the end of the day, humans are competitive creatures. If we don't compete for money, we'll compete for something else. So in other words, it could be tweets, it could be likes, it could be favorable reviews, it could be human empathy, it could be other things. So humans ultimately will find a way of competing on something that is not related to jobs, that is not related to money. But this is decades away, and that's why I'm saying that those two generations in between are in a very, very hard place. And it's not even clear how they can break out of the system. It's not even clear how they can find something else. We all know success stories, but this is a success story one out of 1,000. What about the other 999?
A quick final question to each of you. Gareth first, how confident are you that we can more or less smoothly navigate this, as we more or less did, I know there was a world war, as we more or less did in the decades after the 1930s?
I don't know how to answer that question. It's we muddle through and get through periods of extreme hostility and everything, but it won't be pretty. I don't see how it will be smooth, but the only people who'll be able to answer that question will be those living years in the future. They'll be able to look back and see how we did it.
Victor?
Yeah. That's true. Well, I usually say, if you think of the next 5-10 years, what will be the worst possible outcome? Well, the worst possible outcome, that the whole society and economies collapse and we reset it. Now, what's the best possible outcome? That at some point in time, and a lot of technologists believe we're close to it, there will be an explosion of productivity. The problem is that I don't see how that's going to come through over the next 5-10 years. We're all going to go mad. In a different ways, on a different timetables. But that's probably the most likely answer.
Victor, Gareth, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional on this program, anything briefly to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Gareth?
Yeah, so last time I was on this podcast, we talked about stagflation and the likelihood that we could be seeing a stagflationary impulse in Australia. Westpac's economics team recently said that they think that there's a possibility we could see an economic contraction in the second quarter here. So that's just something to look out for.
Victor?
Well, I think it will be very interesting if actually disinflation comes in very, very quickly. Just like what we had prior to COVID, with slower growth rather than stagflation. So that, to me, over the next 6 months, almost is equally as likely.
Victor, I would love to have you back on the program in 6 months to a year, and we can check in on progress. Thank you, Victor Schwetz, global strategist and author of the book The Twilight Before the Storm, How to Avoid a World on Fire, and ABC business and economics reporter Gareth Hutchins. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, I think you might. No economic question is stupid. You can email us via theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.